We talk a lot about the Bible on this podcast, but if you're someone who hasn't read the Bible for yourself before, or if you're someone who wants to go deeper, it can be really helpful to have a Bible study guide to follow. Yarrow Bible Studies can help you grow in your relationship with God and find answers to the questions that are on your mind. Yarrow Studies are very visually inviting, and they give you space for reflection at the same time as guiding you through the Bible so you can know what it says and what it means for your actual life. No matter where you're coming from or what season of life you're in, Yarrow is the Bible study guide that will help you unearth the truth of Scripture so it can take root in your heart and inspire you to go deeper in your relationship with God. Yarrow offers beautifully designed inductive Bible studies and a free digital app. If you're looking for a place to start with Yarrow Studies, why not grab a copy of their first study, Known, which is all about identity in Christ. You can shop at yarrow.org now and save 10% off with the code ConfrontingChristianity10. You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church.
It metaphysically, effectively, is the ultimate post-truth gambit. It's saying, yeah, I know this isn't true, but the world is a nicer place if we believe as it is. So I want to press the question and say, well, what if it is true? And what if that actually grounds the behavior you want and the ethics you want in a much more robust way than the metaphysical system you subscribe to?
Only in a society where we feel exceedingly safe could we say, I don't think beliefs have strongly meaning life or death kind of consequences.
Because I've met a lot of people for whom just simply reading the Bible, reading the gospel story from beginning to end, has turned their life upside down.
I'm here with my friend Andrew Wilson. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, Rebecca.
Andrew holds a PhD from King's College in London, but did his undergrad at Cambridge University at almost the exact same time as I did, which is very exciting. Although we didn't know each other at that point. Andrew, can you explain why just briefly?
I was not really in church or Christian Union when I was at university. I kind of came, I met God in a powerful way in my third year. But by then, I think I had stopped going to anything that might have meant I would meet you. And also, you were in the dark side at Trinity College and I was at Christ. So, what can you do?
Love that. Okay. Yes, I was a very earnest Christian undergrad in Cambridge. And I'm kind of a very earnest Christian, whatever I am now. So, not a lot has changed. But Andrew then went to King's College London to do his PhD. And he currently serves as a teaching pastor at King's Church London. No kind of direct connection to King's College.
No. Well, the same king, I suppose.
The same king. Well, why not? Andrew is the author of several excellent books, including, I call it Incomparable, but Americans call it Incomparable. I think, what do you call it?
We could, English speakers will call it Incomparable.
Okay, fantastic. So Incomparable, Explorations in the Character of God, God of All Things, Rediscovering the Sacred in an Everyday World, and Echoes of Exodus. And most recently, Andrew has published a fabulous tome called Remaking the World, How 1776 Created the Post-Christian West. It's a little bit of a tongue twister. And I definitely want to pick your brains about that today, Andrew. But first, I want to ask you about one of my favorite photos, which is a photo of you. I'm holding it up for Andrew to see. Those listening won't be able to to see this. But I want Andrew to explain this photo, which is it's you and a woman on the New York Manhattan subway, the equivalent of the London Tube for our English listeners. So tell us what this photo is and why you took it, Andrew.
So it's a picture of me and Rachel Gilson smiling gleefully underneath a picture saying someone to go to heaven with, which I guess is like an advert for a gay club. I think that's what it was, if I remember
right. I don't know. I think it's actually just a sort of dating,
one of these dating
platforms, because it says something with a swipe. I think it's...
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, we were just so delighted that we'd seen it. And then we'd like extra delighted that although we'd only met each other about 6 hours before, that we were just, it was really, really fun getting to know one another. And that I am married to Rachel and she's married to an Andrew. So it's Andrew and Rachel Gilson, Andrew and Rachel Wilson. And then we just felt like sitting under this picture was just too good to be true. So yeah, we just laughed and laughed. It was a good day. It was a scavenger hunt, actually.
This photo is an encapsulation of one of the things I deeply believe, which is that if Christians opened up their Bibles and rediscovered the fact that we are brothers and sisters who are called to love one another, and that love is not only to be found in the context of romantic relationships, but actually in the context of brother and sister relationships, the family of God, that we in fact are all going to heaven together if we put our faith in Jesus, then so many other things will fall into place. So, yes. One day I will post this photo online and it will be to the ruin of both your and Rachel's reputation, because people,
I don't know,
silly
in my case,
things.
I think it might enhance my reputation.
It might enhance yours. Well, never mind. It's just, yeah, delightful. But aside from that, Andrew, when people hear the title of your new book, How 1776 Created the Post-Christian West.
Yeah.
My guess is they'll have two assumptions. Number one, that it's probably all about, you know, the Declaration of Independence and the way in which the, what is now the United States of America, kicked out the British oppressors once upon a time. And number two, that when you say the post-Christian West, you're probably assuming that Christianity is declining, dwindling, dying in the modern world, and that that's sort of inevitable progress. But in fact, neither of those things are true. So tell us first how your book is and is not about the Declaration of Independence.
It's not really about the Declaration of Independence. It's obviously about the year that it, and what I found was, as I started doing the research, was that I was amazed and excited by how many developments that have shaped the modern world in all kinds of different ways can all be traced back to this one dramatic year in which loads of things happened. The invention of the steam engine, the publication of the Wealth of Nations, the height of the French and German enlightenments in many ways, Immanuel Kant drafting the Critique of Pure Reason, the American Declaration of Independence, Captain Cook's voyages, Rousseau, Goethe, like all this stuff, which connects sort of things that happen in economics and technology and politics and in a battle of ideas and Christianity, David Hume dying, having just written his dialogues. And so all these massive events taking place in one year. And so the book is that, is about that year as a window into all of these dramatic changes. And I pick out seven really. But then the year is a really good way of doing it, because it's a year that lots of people, particularly in America, are interested in anyway, but a way of hopefully broadening what that year means, so that instead of simply being a year about a political development or the founding of one state, it becomes a much more interesting year through which to look at all kinds of other things that have made us the kind of people we are. So that's the that's the conceit of the book.
Then
the other thing you're talking about is obviously related, which is the extent to which we're post-Christian or not, and how those seven developments shaped that sort of post-Christian world we're in.
So on that particular point, and going back to the Declaration of Independence, just, you know, we might as well satisfy our American listeners a little by pausing in that place. All of us probably know the famous line, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. How might that line otherwise have come to be known if we look back at the history?
Well, it was originally drafted. So Thomas Jefferson originally wrote, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. And one of the things I do in the book is to try and make that into a parable, really, of the way in which the post-Christian West, and we can talk about that term a bit later, but how the Westerners like us took something that was sacred and therefore undeniable and crossed it out, which is what Ben Franklin then did with Jefferson's draft, crossed it out and replaced it with self-evident. Now, I don't think, you know, so Jefferson writes to Franklin and says, hey, here's my draft. And Franklin writes back and says, yeah, I think you should take out sacred and replace it with self-evident. And by doing that, Franklin did a parable of what Western people have done ever since, which is to say these foundational commitments of the Western world to human, what we might call human rights or human dignity, the need to love other people, to show compassion and mercy to people, to treat everyone equally, all of these things. These are Christian beliefs that have been baked into our culture so thoroughly by Christian history, really, and our sort of our background story, that we don't even realize they're Christian anymore. And we think they're self-evident. And so we function as if everyone agrees with them, and then sometimes collide with uncomfortable reality when we realize that other cultures might not hold the same convictions as we do. And that's because they don't have the same Christian roots we do. And so you end up with this strange situation where people use Christian arguments and Christian logic to critique Christianity and to say, well, we need to move beyond Christianity now because we've got all of these beliefs of love and justice and human equality and dignity, and we can build on them and actually use them as a sort of as weapons against Christianity sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that is not the only thing, but it's a significant part of what the story I'm trying to tell in the book.
So what would you say to somebody who said, okay, you know, let's grant for a minute, and I certainly have friends who would want to contest this in conversations that I have with them. Let's grant for a minute that it was from Christianity in the first place that we got the idea that all human beings are sort of fundamentally morally equal and should be treated in a certain way. Why is it not the case that we can just say, you know, thanks Christianity for that, giving us that once upon a time, but we can now find a much firmer foundation for those beliefs in a sort of secular worldview that doesn't depend on any particular religious tradition?
Well, I think I'd say, I certainly don't think it's on any firmer ground. I think it'd be very hard to argue it was firmer. I mean, I could probably see the argument that someone could say, we've got this now, and because we all agree on it, we don't need the metaphysical grounds for it at all. I think it'd be very strange to argue that we have now got in a, I'm assuming, a sort of materialist-ish, evolutionist-ish account of reality. We could, I think that's what must be, when people say a secular view, I assume that's what they're appealing to. But I think it'd be very strange to say that that provides a firmer ground for the belief that all people are equal and should be treated with dignity than a Christian one, because this is one of the comments I go into in some detail in the book, is that people who have grounded their ethics in a purely materialist account of nature, and in my period, the period of this book, it was the Marquis de Sade, 100 years later, Friedrich Nietzsche, and actually some people even today, they don't end up, people who consistently operate their ethics on that basis end up with the strong eating the weak, and they end up with the humanism effectively being refracted through looking at nature and saying, well, yeah, strong animals eat and kill weak ones, and in the end, that's what, if we were going to build a bottom-up theory of ethics, we would ground it in the way the world really is, which is not that everyone's equal. In fact, people are patently not equal in, you know, size or strength or intelligence or all sorts of other attributes. But we affirm that they're equal anyway because we affirm a Christian belief about them, which is that what really matters is that they are made in God's image, even if they aren't equally intellectually capable or equally physically strong or whatever. We have to cherish and support them anyway. So I think I could see someone saying, oh, well, thanks Christianity, let's move on. But I think to say that there's any ground for that and that it's anything other than just an arbitrary choice is very thin indeed. And I think a lot of the most intelligent representatives of that kind of, yeah, let's move on, basically concede as much. Yeah. And I talk a bit about Yuval Noah Harari in his book and how he basically just goes there. He says, yeah, this is arbitrary. This is a choice. We're deciding. It's not true, but we must believe it because we become kinder societies when we do believe it. Yeah. And I think, that just metaphysically effectively is the ultimate post-truth gambit, is saying, yeah, I know this isn't true, but the world is a nicer place if we believe as it is. So I want to press the question and say, well, what if it is true? And what if that actually grounds the behavior you want and the ethics you want in a much more robust way than the metaphysical system you subscribe to?
Yeah, I find it fascinating reading Yuval Noah Harari's book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and Tom Holland's book, Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. I read those books sort of quite close to each other in time in my own life. And my experience of reading Tom Holland was him discovering that his deepest beliefs that he held as an agnostic were in fact Christian beliefs, and feeling a sort of sense of wistfulness about, you know, a longing toward Christian belief that he felt like he couldn't quite access, but saw how kind of morally naked he was without it, I guess. And then Harari, on the other hand, having these kind of throwaway lines, which it seemed like there was no wistfulness, but he would say things like, you know, talking about the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, all men are created equal. He says, you know, the Americans got the idea of human equality from Christianity, but if we stop believing in God who created humans with souls and, you know, all that jazz, then what does it even mean to say that humans are equal?
Yeah.
He says human rights are figments of our fertile imagination. The scientific study of Homo sapiens has embarrassingly little to do with human rights and equality. Like these sort of things that he kind of throws out there as if the world doesn't suddenly come crashing down around your ears, you know, as soon as you recognize that.
Yeah, but he obviously agrees in a profound way with the story that Tom Holland is telling and the one that I would and you would, I expect, which is to say that these things are not supported intellectually or metaphysically by the worldview that people adopt. It's just that Harari's happy to live with that level of cognitive dissonance. And I'm not, and I don't think people should be, because I think it's something that you can concede as long as you are in a society that broadly, A, shares the same moral assumption, and B, you are in a position that's privileged enough to not need it to be grounded in something deeper.
Yeah.
Because you can say, well, I'm going to be okay. I'm very wealthy. I'm very educated. I'm going to get by. But for someone who's saying, no, the world isn't listening to people like me. I'm trying to contend for people like me to be raised up. And there's no ground for that at all. You're just saying, well, we just accept that and enough people believe it, it's probably fine. Yeah. As Christian foundations become looser, the commitment to the dignity of every single human group gets, over time, was going to get weaker. And I think that means that for all sorts of people, and I speak as a father of a very disabled child and very concerned about the way that people speak about, you know, kids with Down syndrome in the womb or whatever it is, and think, I'm not sure that this is going to withstand what's happening with euthanasia in Canada. And I think, yeah, I'm not sure that this is going to withstand the pouring of Christian foundations. And I don't really want to, I don't really want to be around if it does, because I think that some the experiments we've seen in the past at jettisoning those Christian foundations and trusting that we'll get along anyway have not always gone well. So
yeah,
I'm more skeptical that actually we can sustain the ethics without the metaphysics.
Yeah, he had a fascinating conversation actually over Thanksgiving, you know, during Thanksgiving lunch, which in my house was sort of 30 people milling around, eating stuff and chatting with a friend who has holds a PhD in philosophy, incredibly intelligent guy, wouldn't identify with any kind of particular religious tradition. And we started talking about the resurrection. And he said to me, I don't see the value in accruing beliefs. And I said, oh, this is sort of interesting. Tell me more about that. And he said, yeah, I don't think beliefs are actually particularly important. I don't think they have many kind of consequences. I think people just sort of hold beliefs and, you know, do what they're doing. And I thought, wow, I mean, that's I have a lot of thoughts on that topic. But one of them is, only in a society where we feel exceedingly safe could we say, I don't think beliefs have like meaning, like strongly meaning life or death kind of consequences. And that's, you know, that's the world in which at least many of us live much of our lives. Probably many listening to this podcast do, but many people around the world and throughout history don't. You know, we recognize the ways in which beliefs have huge ramifications. But Andrew, sort of pulling on that thread a little bit more, many people would look back to the Enlightenment as this period of sort of intellectual progress in which humans in the West kind of moved beyond a basic kind of religious way of seeing things into a more rational, objective, verifiable, and kinder, kind of more universally loving and tolerant way of seeing the world and way of doing the world. And that we're kind of on the up, we're the inheritors of that, and that we can actually kind of carry that baton further. I know Steven Pinker a couple of years ago wrote a book called Enlightenment Now, sort of calling for a resurrection of the Enlightenment, a kind of re-engagement, a furthering of the Enlightenment project.
Interesting choice of word.
Yes. So what would you say to somebody who said, yeah, I actually, you know, I don't need Christianity. And in fact, I think Christianity probably takes us a step backwards because I can, you know, look back over history, I can benefit from the thinking of Enlightenment thinkers, and I can, you know, you and I and all of us can kind of proceed on that basis instead of harking back to a more kind of primitive religious way of looking at things.
Well, I think I'd probably say that to go, the strange thing is that primitive religious way of looking at things is in many ways what the Enlighteners were trying to do. that they were in that, and they often talk like that. I mean, Peter Gay's defining in its field talks about the Enlightenment as modern pagans, and says that's really what they were. They were trying to get back behind Christianity to a sort of a pre-world in which you didn't have all the superstitions of Christian dogma thrown in. And often the Enlighteners were strident, many of the key Enlighteners, strident critics of biblical anthropology, strident critics of the Christian understanding of human equality in the sense of all races, often profoundly racist. I mean, the leading, I don't mean in a sort of, well, people of their day kind of way. I mean, people, if you read what people like Kant and Hume and Voltaire wrote about black people or about whatever, it is appalling. And of course, a lot of that came out just after George Floyd's murder. And so, that's not just a gotcha. That's because many of them were deliberately opposing Christian anthropology a la Genesis 1 and saying this is just nonsense. And these different people groups have come from all sorts of different origins. And it's just superstition to say that they, in that sense, are all equal in the sense that we would now. Now, so for somebody to say, well, we've got the Enlightenment, we can just absorb the good ideas and then get, isn't it wonderful? Christianity's given us this foundation, we can move on. So no, that even in the Enlightenment, that wasn't true at all. There's a profound clash of values. Now, admittedly, not every Enlightener was in that position. And some Enlighteners, to their credit, it didn't jettison that kind of anthropology, or they tried to, but retained enough of it that it didn't take them to the same horrible places. But I think if you put that alongside the story of, you know, people like Sade and others at the time, I think you'd say this: the Enlightenment is a much more complicated and ambivalent movement, even about something as foundational as human equality, human dignity, let alone about many of the other values we might want to put beyond it into love and charity and compassion and mercy and things like that, which are more explicitly Christian. And again, I would say, I just don't think that the history of the last of intellectual thought in the last 250 years suggests that those things survive on their own without some metaphysical grounding. Because in the end, you'd get a very direct challenge to it. I think the reason why in the West we still retain some of them is because of our opposition to Nazism, which rightly was obviously, Nazism was an attempt to get rid of Christian morality root and branch and say, let's reinvent it. And because we were so convinced and still are that that was just the worst thing ever, we have retained in a strange way some Christian foundations, not because we are supporting Christianity, but because we know that we want to be anything but the Nazis. But even that memory will fade given long enough. And strong men will rise, as they already do in parts of the, you know, the West in some ways, saying, actually, says who? Like, who's to say that we should give the same level of compassion and charity and mercy towards someone from another group as we do of our own? What about, you know, putting America first? What about what's happening in Hungary? What about, and now, you know, I'm not comparing with those with the Nazis at this point, but to say that actually the moral rationale behind saying why, you know, what is it foundationally that means we should never put ourselves ahead of other people, particularly when the economy doesn't grow as fast or goes backwards, and particularly when there's more people than there are jobs and all those sorts of dynamics. I think I'm not sure that's going to be sustained. So I would love to think that it was as simple as human beings learn a lesson and then they can just scrub the reason they learned it and carry on, and everyone will always remember it. But my studies in history suggest that that is not true of a great many things, and it certainly isn't true of human dignity.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, Seminary President Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. And talk us through, so for those listening who maybe haven't spent much time reading the Bible or kind of have any kind of passing familiarity with the teachings of Jesus, what is it that's specifically Christian about those beliefs that you've just mentioned?
So I think, I mean, human beings, it starts in the first chapter of the Bible, where human beings are created in the image of God, male and female. He created them in his image. And I think that provides a rationale for treating every human being as a representative, as, you know, you could, if you were really pushing the point, almost as an icon, or some of you can go further and say as an idol of God. Now, human beings are not, we don't worship one another, and we shouldn't in Christian thinking. But the idea that this is, if you want to know what God looks like, you don't look at a statue, which is what other ancient religions did and many modern ones. What you do is you look at a human being and say, that is what God is like. And that profoundly changes the way you think about human beings who are not like you. You attribute to them a value based not on their capacity or their functionality, but on their divinely image-bearing identity. So that's very important. I think you then go through the Old Testament, you see that play out in all kinds of ways, and your attitude to the poor, the sojourner, which is a very common biblical category of migrants, or we would call them, or refugees, whatever, the widows, to those who are, for whatever reason, in society, less likely to have what we would now call privileges or rights or whatever, which of course themselves quite Christian ideas. And then you come into the New Testament and you find Jesus, you know, but the moment it's announced that Jesus is going to be born, Mary sings this beautiful song about how, you know, the Lord is going to bring down the mighty from their seat and exalt the humble and meek. And all those, again, all the way in which even now, when people are protesting in my city of London in the last 48 hours about what's going on in Gaza, they are appealing to the moral logic of the Magnificat, which is Mary's beautiful song when Jesus is going to be born, or the moral logic of Jesus dying on the cross, you know, and the weak things of the world being exalted to shame the strong, as Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, or the resurrection, that someone who was dead is now alive again and has become king of the world. And all of these stories, really, which are, I mean, these creation, crucifixion, resurrection, incarnation, I mean, these are the basic Christian beliefs, and all of them in their own ways tell a story about a God who is concerned about lifting up the weak and lowly and dignifying human flesh. Ultimately, God becomes human in Christianity, which is a completely unique religious idea to Christianity. So I don't think you can, you can't talk about a major doctrine of Christianity without seeing this theme in it. And that's why I would contend in the book and elsewhere, that's why I contend Western people find themselves so unable to fathom that you would ever not believe it, because everything about Christianity is shouting it and has done to our culture for a very long time. So it seems like a self-evident truth, to go back to that term. But if you take Christianity out, it isn't, in all kinds of different ways. And I think you can see hints of that in various places in the West today.
So let's think about that then, the idea that the West right now is post-Christian, what that does and does not mean. To tell a sort of anecdote from my life, or rather from my husband's life, when he moved from Oklahoma to Cambridge, UK, to do some graduate study, he assumed that there was absolutely no way he would meet a kind of good Christian girl in England. You know, in his mind, the United Kingdom was a sort of barren wasteland spiritually. And one of the things he was sort of evaluating as he thought, oh, you know, I'd be interested to go and study abroad for a while, was, you know, clearly that would pause any prospects he had of potentially, you know, finding somebody to marry. You know, it was much surprised to find me there, and to find actually, I think one of the differences that he recognized was that whereas, at least at the time in Oklahoma where he was, even if people didn't go to church, they respected the fact that you did. You know, it was kind of seen as a moral advantage to be a regular churchgoer. He moved then to England, where it was absolutely a social cost for him in terms of, you know, in a sort of King's College, Cambridge, to be a serious Christian and a regular churchgoer. And so he realized on Sundays he was showing up to gatherings where everybody else had paid that cost as well. Like, nobody was there because it was the cool thing to do. It was kind of everybody was there because they really believed. So give us a sense. I'm curious, both, I guess, at the high level and at the more granular level, as someone who is working and ministering in London right now, which, you know, many, as I say, in America would look over the pond and see as a desperately secular place. Help us understand what you do and don't mean when you say that the West is post-Christian, and then give us a flavor of what you see happening in London currently in terms of spiritual things.
Yeah, great. So on the post-Christian thing, what I mean by it, I think the best way I can illustrate it is by talking about, is using an analogy, which you also get when it comes to people talking about post-industrial society or post-industrial urban landscapes, for instance, where, in fact, on that, when you started off by showing the picture of me and Rachel on the tube with the heaven, someone to go to heaven with, we were on our way down to a classic sort of post-industrial urban landscape in Manhattan, where obviously it used to be very sort of lots of chimneys and lots of steam and lots of smell and smoke and coal. But now industrialization is so secure that you can just take it for granted that you're going to have enough calories and enough heat, and you can start beautifying urban spaces. And we all love that kind of thing. And we like wood burners, and we like going vegan, and we like all these things. But they're only things you can do because the legacy of industrialization is secure. And when I talk about being post-Christian, that's what I mean. I mean, people feel like what we've just been talking about for the last 15 minutes, that the moral consequences of what Jesus did are so baked into our society that we can take them for granted and move beyond them and start experimenting with all sorts of other kind of views. I mean that. I don't mean the entire society has left Christianity behind. In fact, that's the whole point of the conversation we've been having till now. I mean that people think it is secure and therefore go, oh, well, now we'll dabble in this. We can become a bit spiritual here and a bit pagan there, and we can take this idea from that. And Celtic Christianity's got a nice set of images, but we can blend that with a little bit of Tibetan, this, that, and the other. And and we'll create a sort of pastiche, you know, spiritual but not religious experience for ourselves. That's what I mean by post-Christianity. And I think that would be echoed in my experience in London. Now, London, admittedly, in British terms, is actually much less secular than the nation as a whole in many ways, largely because of immigration. So I'm a pastor in a black majority church and in a black majority borough in London and Lewisham. And there are just many, many, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who've come from parts of the world where Christianity is very assumed and people are very Christian in their practices, and people go to church on Sundays and so on, from whether it's from West Africa or the Caribbean. And so that I'm in that sense, a very Christian part of London in many ways relative to others. But actually the nation as a whole is still very ambivalent about this and in many ways feels very secular when everything's going well. And then when things hit crisis point, suddenly realizes, yeah, we're very Christian, and does rather strange things. And funny enough, you know, you and I were talking about starting at Cambridge at roughly the same time. But the divinity paper, they didn't call it theology or Bible, whatever, but the divinity exam question, my first year at Cambridge, at the end of that, so the summer of 1998, so this is the year after Princess Diana died, the one of the questions in the paper was, secular rationalism or secular humanism drowned in a sea of flowers on the 31st of August 1997.
Wow.
Discuss.
Right.
And that was 25 years ago, but it was a reflection of exactly this idea that British people and post-Christian Westerners go, we're just getting on with it. It was fine. You know, everybody's okay. Things are roughly going all right. Exactly what you said earlier. I'm safe. Generally, I feel like the prospects for my kids are okay-ish. I might have some anxieties, but broadly speaking, we're not at war. We're economically okay. The NHS, our health system, is here to catch us if we're sick. We have a savior. We have a narrative. And then when something crisis happens, even if it's, I say, just a member of the royal family dying, or even the Queen last year, the queue, I mean, it's just extraordinary. And people's reactions at that point show that the secularism is very thin. It's very skin deep. And that underneath it, a longing for transcendence, even if it's slightly inconsistently constructed, is very much still there. And a lot of Christian assumptions pervade through those things. And the King's coronation, I don't know, we watched the King's coronation with friends of ours who aren't Christians, and their mum and their kids. It was like a sort of multi-generational thing. And they're asking us questions about the liturgy, going, what does that mean? And why is this? And you're just expounding this very Christian ceremony. And people are going, oh, and it helps them make sense of something that they long for and don't really understand. And so I don't think we've left Christianity behind as much as we often pat ourselves on the back for having done.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about the kind of racial demographics of the folks who are most likely to be engaged in church in both the UK and the US. Because I think often people have in their minds that once upon a time, the sort of white Western Christianity was the thing, and now that's declined. And we've kind of moved into a world that is more diverse and therefore more secular, that those two things kind of go hand in hand. Like if you have racial diversity, you will also have a kind of upswing in secularity and a downswing in Christianity. When in actual fact, if you look around the world, and even if you look in the West, you see the most growth Christian-wise, typically, in absolutely non-white demographics. It's fascinating. Yeah. Where I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Somerville is one of the adjacent cities, and there English is apparently the third most commonly spoken language at evangelical churches after Portuguese and Creole. So it's like, we're kind of, you and I are kind of exceptional in some ways in the West, as being, white European heritage folks who are following Jesus often.
Yeah,
With brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and in Britain, the most diverse cities are the most Christian ones, and actually the most non-Christian, the hardest place of all the people I know who lead churches or are trying to plant churches in difficult places in Britain are almost entirely in poorer white working class areas. Are the most, they're the areas where the church has lost the most ground, and which is not, it's neither right nor wrong, it's just a reality.
Yeah.
And actually, in the very most, the more diverse things become, the more religiously open in all kinds of faiths they become, but certainly the more Christian, and a lot more Muslims as well, in more diverse areas and urban areas in Britain. So yeah, it's a very, very interesting dynamic. The idea that diversity and secularism are paired together is just bizarre. It's not borne out by the data, at least at a religious level, at all, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. What would you say? So my sense is, Andrew, that you, like me, are something of a gospel optimist, by which I mean, I think temperamentally and theologically, we're people who are not quick to believe that Christianity is sort of withering and on the branch and dying out, and instead we're probably quicker to see the need for and the opportunities for the spread of the gospel today. What would you say gives you the most hope and encouragement now? And what would you encourage if somebody's listening to us, our conversation today, who's not a Christian, but maybe kind of curious about these things? What would you encourage them to do as a next step in terms of exploring Christianity?
Yeah, those are two huge questions. I mean, I think the thing that gives me the most hope in many ways is just the shape of the biblical story, which is that death leads to resurrection, and that God is always at work. Often when, you know, the darkest hour is just before the dawn, often seems to be the way that things reach rock bottom and then God revives. So I think there's a theological optimism, I hope. I don't think it's just being, you know, sunny of disposition or whatever like that. But I do think trend-wise, a lot of what I see relates to the previous comment we had about diversity and religion. I think where Christianity is booming around the world, in sub-Saharan Africa and many other places, actually, in parts of Latin America, East Asia, that's very exciting. And I'm part of an international movement of churches. I often see brothers and sisters from around the world think, wow, what God is doing there gives me enormous hope that you might be able to bring some of that and enliven us. So that's where a lot of the sort of practical optimism comes from. And I just, in my own church, we just see lots and lots of people who are not Christian come to church, meet God, get baptized, join, bring their families up in the faith. I mean, I see that a lot. And so I'm wired to think it's happening more than it really is, but that's my experience. So I think that's where the optimism comes from. So a mixture of theology, a global perspective, and then just pastoral life. And I think some things that are happening in even amongst intellectuals at the moment, which I'm finding quite fascinating, which I dare say you've got into with some other guests. When it comes to what to do, I mean, it just so depends on the person. I mean, I think obviously that there are some very obvious Christian answers to the question, what do I do? You know, it's like, who do you ask? John the Baptist, repent, you know, or whatever. And Jesus, you just say, come and follow me and I'm going to make you, I'll make you the kind of person who fishes up for other people. You go into the world and make disciples, baptizing them and so on. So there's lots of Christian answers you could give. But I do think the next step really does depend on the kind of person you are, because I've met a lot of people for whom just simply reading the Bible, reading the gospel story from beginning to end, has turned their life upside down. And that's, I know, there might be the most listeners of yours go, obviously, I've done that dozens of times. But there's a lot of people I find who, when a lot of very well-educated friends of mine, who if you get said, have you ever just read through John's gospel from beginning to end? I don't mean even in one sitting, although sometimes people do, and they really takes them 2.5 hours and they go, done. Wow, that was not what I thought. So sometimes it's that. Other people, spiritual practices become very important, and they actually, their only pathway to encountering God in the end is going to be through a mixture of personal prayer and participation in Christian worship and liturgy. And sometimes that's how they just go through the journey of a Christian worship service and find themselves astonished at the end of it going, I don't even know. I met so many people like this where I don't even know what it was, but I experienced something of the wonder of this story by being part of a prayer context or prayers of confession and worship and so on. And I'm a charismatic church, and a lot of people just, again, come into our church and they're just something about seeing everyone's hands raised in worship, participating and singing out. They go, whoa, this is, I don't have a category for this. Yeah. I've only seen something like this at a football match. There's a meaning to this worshiping encounter that doesn't make sense. I can't make sense of in other categories. And then other people, it is a sort of the classic go around to somebody's house for a meal and talk about it kind of thing, whether in a formalized way, like an Exploring Christianity course, which we run all the time in our church, or just in a kind of way you have people around your house at Thanksgiving, no doubt, and talk to them about Christian things. So there's a lot of different, it kind of depends on the person as to what kind of ways in which they need to take a next step and what might be most helpful for them. But I find that most people, on hearing that range of options and many others, go, that's probably the kind of thing that would work for me, if anything would. Some people it's silence, some people it's very noisy, some people it's very intellectual, some people it's much more emotional. And I just think you kind of, if there's a, people are, have got a bit of self-awareness at this point, they can go, yeah, it's probably something like that would help me.
So last question, Andrew, which is more personal to you. You said that when you were first couple of years of undergrad, you were not engaged in Christian things. And then in your third year, you became so again. What was it for you that actually made Jesus persuasive, beautiful?
So that kind of happened in two stages. First of all, I got hoiked back to church by some really good friends who I think lived lives of faithfulness and integrity in front of me. And didn't waver. And they were not like kind of dogmatic, ranty people at all. They're just incredibly winsome, warm men and women who I just thought, yeah, that there is a reality to this. I'm trying to live two lives here, but saying I believe one thing, not living it at all, and feeling like I've got to do all of this stuff in the world in order to feel like I'm a valid person. And it just isn't working. So part of that was the first part. And then I think over the next year and a half, there was an intellectual component as well. I just sort of disappeared. Actually, for me, a lot of it was into Tom Wright's work. I know you would know that name. Some listeners will. He was Bishop of Durham at the time, and his work on Jesus and then the resurrection. And I thought this is just, I think this is actually historically true. I think this is really what happened. I think Jesus was a real first century Jew who said and did some extraordinary things that no one could explain, died on a Roman cross, and then was raised from the dead, and actually did step out of the tomb alive again 3 days later. And if that's true, then everything in the world is different. And that's, I've believed that ever since. And I think probably that combination of a sort of social, seeing it played out in reality in people's lives, mixed with an intellectual persuasion, is probably what made the difference for me. And as I've been living with that for over 20 years since.
Love it. Thanks so much, Andrew, for chatting with me. You've been listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast. You can follow us on Twitter/X, or maybe we'll call it Y just to be controversial, or Instagram, or you can leave a review on iTunes. And please join me next week when I'll be talking with another friend about the story of the Bible. Until then.